So hello and welcome to the Poetry Pause, a podcast from a cowshed in West Wales. Emma Baines, historian, and myself are here to discuss poems of hope, healing and having a laugh. Hello Emma.
Hello, how are you today Pippa?
Very good, thank you. Now, what have you been doing since we last spoke? Have you got a book out or something?
There's a book coming out in work. I work at Narberth Museum and there's a little celebration of 10 women from Pembrokeshire who historically have achieved great things.
And are these women we would have all heard of?
No, or? No, they're people who may otherwise have been lost or forgotten in history.
Oh, great. So sort of forgotten, overlooked women.
Yes.
And when is this book coming out?
Imminently, in the next few weeks.
That's very exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I know you're saying it as though the museum has delivered this book, but actually museums don't deliver books, do they? People do. So big kudos to Emma here. This is brilliant.
Thank you.
Very exciting. Over lockdown, we did this session at Llandeilo Litfest online. You chaired it really brilliantly.
And I'd like to welcome you all to the fourth Llandeilo Litfest and the first ever one online. I'm a little bit nervous, but we're going to go for it.
And we had some guest poets on Poems for Hope, Healing and Having a Laugh, one of whom, Natalie Holborough, we're going to feature today quite a bit. But does poetry give us hope and healing?
I think absolutely it does. Yeah, it's a comfort. It makes sense of things, quite literally using words, putting words to things that you may not be able to express yourself. So for me, it brings comfort and a sense of understanding.
And how does it do that?
I think there's something very special about poetry in that often it's in very neat, little, digestible sections that you can kind of dip in and out of.
Yeah.
It doesn't ask too much of you in terms of time, but it stays with you. And it's like a little companion that understands you and makes sense of something that you can't yourself.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like Hilary Mantel, is it? It's not like there's this kind of massive tome there waiting for you. It's something that is quite portable. And it's often in the form of an arrangement on a page, isn't it? Or an arrangement and an arrangement of sound patterns.
Yeah.
So I suppose it's something to do with making order out of chaos.
Absolutely.
We've chosen poems today to illustrate our chat, really, and they're from poets that we've already looked at in the earlier episodes of the series. Listeners, if you've not heard them, they're brilliant. How did you pick these poems? What were your kind of criteria for picking them?
The poems I've selected, for me, had a kind of immediacy. Well, all of them, actually, sprouting from ordinary experiences, everyday experiences. They kind of neatly portrayed what it is to be alive day to day. They engage with deeper meaning, like all poetry does, but they felt like they engaged with day to day life, and that brings me comfort.
And it
gives something to me, and I don't feel like it's taking from me. I don't have to spend a lot of time deciphering what they're saying or trying to understand them. I feel they understand me.
Yeah. So these poems get you.
Yeah.
So they're empathetic in a way.
And
I suppose they relate to something that's recently been discovered called mirror neurons, where we see an emotion expressed in another human being or even an animal, actually, and then they fire neurons in our brain that make us feel similar emotion.
Yeah.
It's a really massive insight in terms of the brain science. So I suppose our mirror neurons get fired in some way. One of the things I've been thinking about a lot preparing for this episode is, what is the difference between music and poetry and its effect on me? And in a way, I suppose, I often have music on in the background and I don't have to listen to it that attentively. Whereas if I hear a poem or I'm listening to sort of spoken word, I do have to listen and think about it a bit more. So they've both got rhythm, haven't they? They've both got flow. They've both got repetition. They both involve expression. But there is a difference, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you have any views on this?
Yeah, I think that music, you can have it on in the background. It can wash over you. And it will stay in the back of your mind, like it's almost there kind of embedding itself without you being aware of it.
Yeah.
Whereas poetry, it does demand your awareness.
Yeah.
But I think once you've read it or listened to it, often in the same way as music does, it stays somewhere in the back of your mind and kind of impacts on you.
Yeah.
I guess you're really interested in this because you're a psychologist as well, the connection between poetry and what it does to you psychologically. Have you got any thoughts about that? Or
yes, I mean, I think it's probably a bit, for me anyway, it's a bit more of a active distraction.
Yeah,
you know, I have to put my attention fully on it.
Yeah,
so I couldn't just have it on in the background.
Yeah,
when I was ill a few years ago, I went in for an op, you know, quite a big op, and one of the things I was dreading was, oh my goodness, I'm going to be on a really noisy ward and how am I going to cope? You know, I'll take my headphones and what have you. But actually, one of the things that I found immensely comforting through that time was the background burble of people talking.
Yeah.
And people talking about silly things and the sort of daytime TV on in the ward. That kind of, all those words sort of being spoken in the background.
Yeah.
I actually found that to indicate to me there are other people here and you're just part of loads of other people going through similar experiences and people wanting to help and things. I loved that burble.
Yeah.
And I still often think about it, how I loved that burble,
mm-hmm.
which is just as well because I needed four more operations. But I was all fine now. But,
yeah.
You know, so the burble became very much part of my life. But, you know, we've heard a lot of us been lucky enough to hear our mum's voices or dad's voices before we go to sleep when we're very small. It's quite basic stuff, isn't it? The comfort of another, it's a voice, albeit you may be receiving it from the written page.
Yeah, and I think as well, poems, that in one respect, they force you inside yourself to really engage with how you feel. But the act of reading or listening to a poem also takes you outside of yourself. You're not thinking about everything. You're focusing, you're concentrating.
Yeah.
And you're comforted.
Yes, yeah. Okay, what's your first choice then?
So my first choice is Night Drive by Seamus Heaney.
Great.
Night Drive. The smells of ordinariness were new on the night drive through France. Rain and hay and woods on the air made warm drafts in the open car. Signposts whitened relentlessly. Montreuil, Abbeville, Beauvais were promised, came and went, each place granting its name's fulfilment. A combine groaning its way late bled seeds across its work light. A forest fire smouldered out. One by one, small cafes shut. I thought of you continuously, 1,000 miles south where Italy laid its loin to France on the darkened sphere. Your ordinariness was renewed there.
Great, thank you. Do you want to tell us a bit about why you picked that?
So I picked this because of what we've just discussed about finding something in everyday life that seems at first unremarkable, but is comforting and familiar. You know, the whole idea of being free in an open car is what you initially think is giving you the comfort, but it's not. It's the memory of home, the memory of something very familiar, in this case, the speaker's wife, I assume. Yeah, just being ordinary feels very tangible and familiar and comforting, and the idea of a connection to a static place rather than moving through these beautiful open spaces. You know, it kind of turns the idea of comfort and fulfilment on its head a little bit and how we can be still.
Yes, yeah. Because does the word ordinariness come twice in this poem?
It does, at the beginning and the end.
Ah, right, yeah. So It really has the rhythm, doesn't it, of somebody in a car at night. You can just hear it, the way he's used those words and the meter.
And he's looking for that ordinariness and that tangibility all the way through the signposts, the hay, the rain. He's focusing on the detail. So he's in his journey, he's actually focusing on the static and the still and the comforting.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a cliche, isn't it, in kind of reality TV and lots of books about characters going on journeys. Yeah. But the frame of a journey is immensely comforting, I think, and it's universally acknowledged and known, isn't it? So one of the poems that I picked is by Billy Collins.
Yeah.
I actually think Billy Collins is a one-man or two-person comfort machine as regards poetry, mm-hmm. because he and his wife, Susanna, they do these broadcasts on Facebook yeah. throughout lockdown a couple of times a week. And they are amazing. And the time he does it is often bedtime here because he's in the US, but so I often fall asleep listening to Billy Collins.
The ultimate comfort.
Yeah, wonderful. So I'm not going to read this whole poem, but it starts, it's called Directions. It starts with, you know the brick path in back of the house, the one you see from the kitchen window, the one that bends around the far end of the garden where all the yellow primroses are. And then it takes the person through familiar layout of this landscape. And then it ends with, still, let me know before you set out. Come knock on my door, and I will walk with you as far as the garden, with one hand on your shoulder. I will even watch after you and not turn back to the house until you disappear into the crowd of maple and ash, heading up toward the hill, piercing the ground with your stick.
Mm.
There's tremendous warmth, I think, in that poem, and it's basically saying, you're not alone. Yeah. You know, here are the directions for going somewhere, but I'm looking out for you, kind of thing. Mm. So I think it's incredibly comforting. But again, it's all about a journey, and a journey in quite an ordinary setting.
Yeah. But again, it's grounded. That last part starts with still.
Yes.
And it pierces the ground with a stick. It's moments of stillness.
Yeah, yeah.
It's asking us to notice, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Who is your next suggestion?
Shall we turn to Adrian Rich?
Yes, who we love and have done a wonderful episode on.
Mm-hmm. So the next poem I've chosen is The Fact of a Doorframe by Adrian Rich. And I'm not going to read all of it. I'm going to read the first and last stanza. The fact of a doorframe means there is something to hold on to with both hands while slowly thrusting my forehead against the wood and taking it away, one of the oldest motions of suffering, as Macabre sings a courage song for warriors. Music is suffering made powerful. Now, again, poetry, violent, arcane, common, hewn of the commonest living substance into archway, portal, frame. I grasp for you, your blood-stained splinters, your ancient and stubborn poise as the earth trembles, burning out from the grain.
Amazing. Okay, so what led to this choice?
This is one of my favourite poems of all time ever. It really speaks to me. I get it. And this is one of the reasons why I love poetry so much. Just every so often you'll get something you think, I know what that means, what that feels like. And the idea of something you can grab hold of, a doorframe, poetry, the creative act, is just so comforting.
Yeah, yeah. Is it about her? Is she banging her head against the doorframe, do you think? It's almost quite violent, the beginning. There's
violence
in there, isn't there?
Yeah. Yes, yeah, maybe it is. But again, the idea of a doorframe is something you're moving through, but you're stopping, you're pausing. It feels like you're right there. You're not in your past. You're not looking at the future. You're right.
Immediately in the present.
Standing still. And just this acceptance of how it's not going to necessarily bring you joy in that moment, but it doesn't matter. Everything you feel is valid and,
yes,
you know, it's
yes.
bloodstained and it's splintery and it's trembling, and but it's okay.
Yeah, it's very tangible and sort of visceral, isn't it? This poem, how it speaks to me is that it's about portals. It's about going through something, and that can be the most terrible, violent experience. It is about the possibility of transformation. And in some ways, that's what poetry does, doesn't it? It puts experience, which, if it's felt very deeply, we often find it quite difficult to articulate. If you think about how we react physically when we're traumatised, often we get a seizing up in the throat, a tightening in the chest. Our actual physical apparatus for speaking doesn't work terribly well. Yeah. So it moves the experience into words. You know, somebody called poetry, didn't they? Word music.
Yeah.
It makes that experience, puts it into words. And to some extent, then, I suppose it slightly removes the experience from us.
Yeah.
Because, you know, words are the frame through which writers and avid readers often interpret their worlds a lot, aren't they? But so it puts it into that definite frame.
Yeah. And at the same time, there is a possibility of moving through it. It literally is something you walk through.
Exactly, so, yeah. Yeah, and of course, every civilization and every nation in the world creates poetry. I came across this amazing book when we were preparing this episode called Poetry as Survival. It's written by Gregory Orr, who very tragically was responsible for his brother's death when he was 12 in a hunting accident with a gun. And he has written the most amazing book about poetry as survival. And I'll just read a little bit about why he wrote it. I lived for about 4 years after my brother's death without any hope at all. Nothing that I found in my culture sustained me. Even my relationship with the natural world, which had been so important to me earlier, was not enough to alter my grief, despair and guilt. Then, thanks to Mrs. Irving, the librarian in my small public school, I discovered poetry. And he's done an amazing analysis of how poetry helps us in terms of the honesty of the poet, which again is a really important aspect of resilience. I mean, you feel Adrienne Rich gets you there, doesn't she? So there's a sort of intimacy and connection in poetry. We experience it as a one-to-one thing, whether we're listening, reading it, or indeed, I think, even sitting in a poetry gathering, it still speaks to us personally.
Yeah.
Which is why it's really difficult to say what's bad or good poetry. If it speaks to people, then
absolutely. It's totally subjective, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Is there anything else you want to say about that amazing poem? And
yeah, if we return to the Goose Girl, I can think that kind of hints towards our culture of fairy tales and nursery rhymes and how comforting that is. You know, if we go again to the voice of our mothers when we're very young, it's part of a whole tradition of how poetry and story is comfort.
Yes, yeah, and has been so since time immemorial, yeah. Really. There's something very interesting about this poem as well, I think. It talks about Macabre. So poetry includes voices that we often don't necessarily hear in mainstream culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's really become highlighted in the past year or so.
Yeah.
It's interesting because Gregory Orr wrote that book in 2002, and he talks about the overculture in it, by which he means mainstream media as we'd know it now, and that, you know, poetry represents a broader church than that. And there's definitely comfort in that, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
We talked so far about us as recipients of poetry rather than creators. But of course, in Llandeilo, we did this session with the fabulous Natalie. And this is what she had to say about her collection, Small.
And maybe, Natalie, you could talk a little bit more about it and read from the collection for us. Welcome, Natalie.
Hi. Yeah, you mentioned that Small actually is quite a big voice. And I think that was the difficulty in so long was Small, it represents an eating disorder to me. And I found for years and years and years with traditional therapy, they often wanted to talk about like a part of your brain. They'd often ask, what is the part of your brain saying? I couldn't relate to it and I'd become really frustrated because I felt like it was obviously it had a huge effect on me, but the thing itself was small. So I happened to be just going along on a run one day and I realized that chattering in my head had suddenly gone quiet. And that's when I'm most at peace, is when I'm out in nature and I'm running. And I thought, I had this image of this small creature just bouncing along on my back, almost like a child just after a really bad tantrum. Because also when I wake up in the morning, it will, you know, sort of like go for a run. And sometimes I need to sit down and be like, do I want to go for a run? Or is this small shouting at me? And then I thought of this creature and I thought, that's what it is. It's like a tantrum in child that I have to deal with every day, because as much as I hate it, I can't leave it. It's still a part of my life. So I just turned it into a character. And then as soon as I got back to the writing desk after that run, I wrote Small in about 6 months because it was just the voice that seemed natural to me.
Yeah.
Okay, great. What next?
So the last poem I've chosen is Praise Song for My Mother by Grace Nichols. Deep and bold and fathoming, you were moon's eye to me, pull and grained and mantling. You were sunrise to me, rise and warm and streaming. You were the fish's red gill to me, the flame tree spread to me, the crab's leg, the fried plantain smell. Replenishing, replenishing. Go to your wide futures, you said.
Wow, what a last line that is. Go to your wide futures, you said. I am pretty sure that's why you picked that, amongst other reasons.
It's, as we discussed before, it's a short little thing you can carry with you. And again, it's realistic. She's talking about her mother in the past tense all the way through. So we know she's lost her mother, but she's really honouring and celebrating her in a very real way. It's very precise. The words, the choices of word, they just distill everything that her mother was to her. It's just so evocative. I love this poem.
Yeah, yeah. It's so musical, actually, yeah. Isn't it? The repetition and the sounds.
Yes.
I mean, when I was listening to you then, it was almost like listening to a song.
And I can hear the sea in it.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah.
It's really great. I mean, of course, the other thing poetry does is plays with words and sounds. And as part of dealing and feeling hope and healing, we do need to have a laugh.
Yeah.
And there are poems that really make you laugh a lot and are poems that are incredibly playful.
Yes.
And this poem, I would say, is quite playful. And
it is playful, yeah.
Appeal to a child as much as an adult. Yeah,
absolutely. And it's just so hopeful. It's so hopeful when it ends. There's so many possibilities. It's not a wide future, it's wide futures.
Yeah.
It could be anything.
I mean, that is a message you so want to get through to kids, isn't it? You have wide futures.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And speaking of ordinariness, do you remember, Emma, Natalie read a poem at Llandilo Litfest about something quite ordinary in a way, a car.
Yeah.
So I think it'd be good to hear that now.
The next one is one that came later into the collection, and it was a way of, if we're talking about writing as healing, processing the, I think everyone's gone through so much trauma the past year, and it's almost like we went into this shock initially because we didn't know how to articulate it. And then eventually it started to come out in poetry. So I just tried to capture that feeling and just flow with it. And that this is the poem that came out with it. Sometimes you cry in this car. The great shivery out-breath that tries to bear the world's ache comes rasping out again, then backs up into silence, waiting to fall into memory trap. It makes no sense. Heat murmuring on the bonnet of the car, its death engine that might once have roared into summer, the sunlight on its registration plate like houseflies on butter. Sometimes you cry in this car with the engine off, and that feeling you sometimes get like stepping out into a cramped elevator, a train without any schedule, both hands on the wheel sticky, as though you'd pressed them too long against the shimmering fever of the universe.
Great. So we can move on to our poems now. So, Emma, what have you come up with?
The poem that got me really thinking about this is, again, a Grace Nichols poem. It's Beauty. And just trying to describe what it is to feel comforted.
Yeah.
It's called With a Pebble in My Pocket. Soothe is a thumbstone smoothed over, a space in awe to heal and hold flesh, catch breath, pulse press chest to chest with the lungs of the earth. Soothe is a thumbstone weathered by the waves, adrift at the shore, but certain.
That's a great ending. That's lovely, that poem. I mean, it's interesting because you said Grace Nichols was, and you could hear the sea, because my goodness, I can hear the sea in that. It really sounds like waves coming over. It's really great. Yeah. Now, interestingly enough, one of the bits of advice that psychologists often give people who are suffering from performance anxiety is actually to hold a pebble in your hand, in your pocket.
Really?
And to squeeze onto it and direct all your tension into that pebble.
Yeah.
So you have written the poem for that advice.
Oh.
So when we do our Poetry as Therapy book, this will be at the front.
Okay.
Now, I haven't written anything specially for this today because I put little poems up on Instagram over lockdown, you know, relating to what I felt was going on. So if you were prescribing for anybody now, maybe some practice in poetry or some collections they might get hold of, what would you suggest?
The books that I go back to again and again are the Blood Axe books on staying alive and being human, that range.
Yeah.
Because they engage with all human experience and writers from all around the world with their own experiences. So I think there's something in those books that everyone can engage with and everyone will find their thing.
Yes, yeah, yeah. There are four of them now, I think, aren't they? They're by Blood Axe Books and edited by Neil Astley, who's done an incredible job.
Yeah.
I read some advice last week which said, find an inspirational text to connect with first thing in the morning. So I think you could, if you wanted to, you could probably take those Blood Axe books, have a little sift through in the evening before you go off to sleep with, you know, poetry as your inspiration for sweet dreams. And then as soon as you wake up in the morning, have put your bookmark in on that poem and you start the day with it.
Absolutely.
Which I think sounds great.
Yeah.
It really is poetry as therapy.
Yeah.
And just gives you a little pause to go into a different place, really, for a bit. Before we finish, thank you, Emma, for this great selection and your own poem, which is lovely. Well, we're just going to leave the last words, actually, with Emily Dickinson, who, of course, wrote some amazing stuff that has brought comfort to loads of people. After great pain, a formal feeling comes. The nerves sit ceremonious like tombs. The still heart questions, was it he that bore? And yesterday or centuries before? Thanks for listening. If you've got any suggestions of poems or poets that have brought you hope, healing and given you a laugh, we would love to hear from you. Please just post them on one of our social media streams. And thanks for listening.